Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
So what I thought I would do today is focus on a theme that I think has evolved in our laboratory where we can begin to both understand disease and impact disease through the lens of reprogramming cells either to do what we want them to do or to recognize that in certain disease states, the basis for disease is actually a cellular reprogramming event. And once we understand that, that provides avenues for potential intervention. And I am trained as a pediatric cardiologist, so my comments will be largely focused through the lens of heart disease. But I do want to emphasize that the conceptual framework and the approaches could be applied, I think, to most human diseases. And so with regards to heart disease, of course, this remains the number one killer worldwide. And we've gotten better at keeping people actually alive after acute events. But the end result of that has been a growing population that are left with damaged hearts and what we call heart failure clinically. And there are over 25 million people now worldwide who suffer from heart failure. Ultimately, these individuals would require a heart transplant, but even in the United States, there are only about 3,000 heart transplants done per year, and many countries don't have any available at all. And on the other end of the age spectrum is congenital heart malformations, where children are born with malformed hearts. And this is the most common human birth defect. It occurs in 1% of all live births across the world, so it's a huge number. And here too, we've gotten better at palliating those defects and keeping children alive. And as they get older, we're beginning to see a number of sequelae that happen as they get older into adult life, including heart failure, but also, as I'll show you, we believe that some of the same genetic abnormalities that result in malformations affect homeostasis of the organ later on. And so my laboratory has, over the years, focused on trying to deeply understand the gene networks that are at play in cardiac cell fate decisions early on and subsequent morphogenetic events, with the notion that we could utilize that knowledge in two distinct ways. One, to regenerate damaged hearts, and I'll show you a few examples of approaches we've taken harnessing the cells that are already in the organ, either the fibroblast population or the cardiomyocyte population itself. And also that we could use this developmental biology knowledge to understand the genetic basis for heart disease, and not only understand that, but decipher mechanism that would lead to new therapeutic modalities. And I'll show you an example of that. Now, to start with the regenerative area, we've published a body of literature in this space. And I want to just in the next few slides summarize for you some of what we've learned from that. And I'll spend the bulk of the time of this talk focusing more on genetics. But in this realm, we've taken two approaches to try to create new muscle in the heart after damage. And I should say that many other groups are trying to transplant pluripotent stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes into the heart. And I'm very hopeful that we'll, as a field, be able to overcome some of the current hurdles with that. And I'm eager to see those develop. Our laboratory took a different approach. And we decided to ask if we could get the cells that are already in the organ to do something they don't normally do. And one thing that they don't normally do, which is why the heart has little to no capacity to regenerate, is they permanently exit the cell cycle very soon after birth. And the result of that is that if muscle is lost, there's really no replenishment. And so some years ago, we found a way to quite efficiently get these adult cardiomyocytes to re-enter the cell cycle and divide, and that is one approach that we're pursuing to regenerate the heart. And the other is to harness the fibroblast population that's in the heart and reprogram them directly into new cardiomyocyte-like cells. Now, on this front, what we reported some years ago was that a combination of four cell cycle regulators that are all highly expressed during fetal development when the heart is dividing and all get downregulated soon after birth, if we reactivated those and stimulated both G1S transition as well as a G2M transition, we could get 15 to 20% of adult myocytes in vivo to re-enter the cell cycle. And that was enough to increase cardiac output and improve function in animal models. And the important thing here we found is that if you had all four factors, you got stable cell division. And what I mean by that is if we remove any one of them, the cells actually could divide in many cases, but then they'd undergo mitotic catastrophe very quickly and kill themselves. So this is a very encouraging, but for these experiments, we had delivered these factors with a virus. And that we presumed early on was a non-starter for clinical translation because of course these could also be oncogenic. And so we had tried years ago to deliver this as an mRNA because one of the problems with mRNA is that they only create protein for about 3 or 4 days at the most. That was perfect for this application where you want these cell cycle regulators there for a few days, the cells divide and then you want it to be gone. It turned out that we could never get good delivery or expression. And it turned out that, you know, when the COVID vaccine was developed, what many people don't realize is the mRNA technology, of course, was quite old. But what made that possible was new advances in lipid nanoparticle technology that allowed better delivery. So with that in mind, we revisited this idea recently, and in collaboration with Kevin Healy and Niran Murthy's laboratories at UC Berkeley in the bioengineering department, we've screened for new LNPs that might have a tropism or propensity to deliver payloads specifically to the heart and specifically in areas of injury. So what I'm showing you here is an LNP we found recently that has been injected systemically into a reporter mouse where we're delivering an mRNA of Cre recombinase, and if the protein's expressed, you get a fluorescent red marker activated. And this is the heart here with the light sheet microscopy, and I'm gonna play a movie for you. And you can see at the apex is where there's been damage after coronary occlusion. And you can see there's accumulation of Cre recombinase protein depicted by the red here in this area of damage specifically. And this is with the whole body delivery. And if you zoom in, you can see many of these cells are actually quite large, and those are the cardiomyocytes that we've documented in other ways. And you also see these small cells, which are the fibroblast cells. So we believe we have a pretty good delivery system now, and we're revisiting the ability to stimulate proliferation and improve cardiac output with delivery of those cell cycle regulators with this lipid nanoparticle. So we're awaiting results for that, but we think at least we have a good delivery mechanism that's non-viral now for the heart. Now, the other approach that I mentioned is after injury, this heart that you see here in blue and purple is all the scar tissue that has replaced the viable myocytes. And it turns out that the cells, of course, that make the scar tissue are the fibroblast pool, which turns out to make up 50% of the heart in both animals and in humans. And so these fibroblasts are also the ones that make scar tissue. And some years ago, we asked, could we utilize our developmental biology knowledge when nature is making heart cells and redeploy cues into these adult fibroblasts that are already in the heart and convert them to be more cardiac myocyte-like? And in fact, we were able to, with the combination of essential developmental transcription factors, particularly GATA4, MEF2C, and TBX5, and together those three proteins we found could bind to DNA in a combinatorial code across the genome and wholesale switch the epigenetics of an adult fibroblast to be more cardiomyocyte-like. And in mice, rats, and in pigs, we could do this with enough efficiency, particularly in vivo, to improve cardiac output And importantly, these cells electrically coupled with their neighbors, which was essential for to get a coordinated contraction in the heart so that you can improve cardiac output and not have arrhythmias, which has been a problem with transplanted cardiac cells. So that was great. We had the conceptual framework for this reprogramming, but in fact, these three factors did not fit into a single AAV that would be the best delivery vehicle for this, and there was much work to be done to really translate this. And so years ago, we put this into a company we called Tenaya Therapeutics in South San Francisco, and they've raised a lot of money over the years to try to move this forward and done a tremendous amount of work to narrow the genetic material to fit into a single AAV, develop a novel capsid that could efficiently infect fibroblasts, not myocytes, and a variety of other delivery hurdles. So they've done that, and I'm going to show you just some one slide of data from Tenaya where they've done a coronary occlusion in this pig heart, which is similar to human. And you can see here at the bottom, this heart gets blanched. It's the area of damage. And then they waited a month to let the function decrease and stabilize in the pig. So the ejection fraction, or the fraction of blood that is pumped out of the heart with every beat, has gone down from, say, 60%, which is normal, to about 30%. And then they administered the therapeutic after that 1 month post myocardial infarction. And what I'm showing you here is the data over a 2 month period after delivering the dose compared to control pigs who got a control vector. And you can see here in the control pigs in gray, the function stayed about flat, which is what we'd expect. They've already stabilized their decrement. In contrast, in the blue lines, you see that these pigs went from about 30% to low 40s, which isn't normal, but it's enough to get out of the conversation of whether or not one should be considering a heart transplant. And enough, people can walk up a flight of stairs. They can walk several blocks. And so that essentially is the goal here. And tonight has a number of other hurdles to still overcome, particularly with a non-invasive delivery method that they're continuing to pursue. But what I've tried to share with you in this part is how, in both cases, if we understand the gene networks at play well enough, we can imagine ways to reprogram those cells to do something that they don't normally do that could lead to regenerative repair. Now, one of the things that I won't spend much time today on, but I'll just briefly in one slide in a cartoon form summarize your recent findings that I'm also excited about is the fact that even if you don't lose any more myocytes and when somebody has heart failure, what we do know is that they reliably continue to decline in cardiac function over time. And the reason for that is this cardiac fibroblast population gets inappropriately activated and lays down more and more fibrotic tissue throughout the heart globally, and that impairs cardiac function. And so in a body of work in our lab led by two very talented postdocs who are both running their own laboratories now, Mikhail Alexanian and Arun Padmanabhan, they started to investigate how is it that the heart senses the stress that it's under, and how does it then signal to activate these fibroblasts to become profibrotic? And it's really quite interesting what they found, which is that they were able to map a very specific stress-dependent enhancer in the macrophage population in the heart. So these, we believe, are the sensing cells of stress. And this enhancer activates a number of cytokines, including, maybe most importantly, interleukin-1 beta. And interleukin-1 beta is then secreted and received by a specific receptor on neighboring fibroblast. And that signaling pathway then they mapped to another very specific stress-dependent enhancer that activates a transcription factor they discovered, MEOX1, that turns out to be the master regulator of a transcriptional switch taking a fibroblast from a quiescent state into an activated state. And the reason I think it's important they were able to trace all these steps is each of these then serves as a potential target to go after therapeutically, either an antibody against interleukin beta that they have shown is functional, or deletion or blocking of this enhancer, or this transcriptional switch. And each of these gives you a specific level of specificity that we believe will reduce the potential off-target effects of, say, just blocking the pathway completely, especially if we can intervene at the enhancers that are only active during stress. So that's all I'm going to say about this part of the work, but we are very excited about this potential to arrest, at least, the cardiac function so it doesn't continue this decline. Now, for the remainder of the talk, I'd like to focus on our efforts at understanding genetics of heart disease. And here also, our laboratory has published a body of literature over time. I want to focus today on two stories, one that represents a long arc of investigation in my laboratory, and the other that is more recent unpublished work. So the first is related to this specific form of heart disease that turns out to be the third most common form of adult heart disease, and it involves specifically the aortic valve in the heart, which separates the left ventricle from the body. And what happens in a large number of people is that this aortic valve gets calcified over time and doesn't open and close properly and ultimately needs surgical replacement. It's an age-dependent phenomenon, and so the incidence increases as people get older. And interestingly, there is a link to a congenital defect that occurs in a subpopulation of this, where some people are born, instead of having three nice valve leaflets that form this nice Mercedes sign, as you see here, they're born with only two aortic valve leaflets. And most of the time, they don't even know they have it. But as they get older, about a third of these individuals will develop early and more aggressive calcification. And it turns out that 1-2% of the entire population worldwide is born with the bicuspid aortic valve. But like I said, most don't even know it until later decades in life. But sometimes the valve is so malformed that even in the newborn period, children have difficulty with blood getting out of the heart and they need an acute intervention to stay alive. So it's a whole spectrum of disease from fetal or childhood to adult onset. So the genetic cause of this disease had not been known till some years ago when I took care of the little boy here at the bottom of this family tree when I was in UT Southwestern in Dallas. And that boy was newborn and had severe aortic valve stenosis from this thick aortic valve that we had to put a catheter across, blow up a balloon, rip it open, and then he was able to survive. But what was interesting is upon taking a family history, it turned out there are multiple generations of individuals indicated in these black circles or squares that had already had open heart surgery because of calcified aortic valve leaflets. And so this is clearly autosomal dominant in transmission, meaning it's likely a monogenic disorder. And we are able to, even back then, map the single gene that was causing this. And it turned out that this disease in this family was caused by a heterozygous loss of function mutation in NOTCH1. So NOTCH1, I'm sure, is very familiar to all of you. It's a famously studied gene. It's important in development of almost every organ in our body and in some maintenance in the adult. And so it's curious that reducing the dose of the protein by 50%, which is what happens here, was caused disease just in the aortic valve and nowhere else. And since then, our lab and many other groups have identified a number of individuals and families with NOTCH mutations, ranging from aortic valve calcification in the adult all the way to even fetuses that have such a severe aortic valve obstruction in utero that their left ventricle doesn't even form as a fetus, and they are born with a very severe kind of congenital heart lesion, missing a whole chamber of the heart. So that was great. This is our first known genetic cause of this common disease. We were very excited, and we thought, okay, now we can begin to understand it. But then we hit a roadblock. And mice that were heterozygous for NOTCH1, which of course had been made much earlier, were normal. homozygous null mice died at embryonic day 9.5 from vascular failure because notches also the end on the endothelial lining of the whole vasculature. So this became a nice to know, but we had very little idea of mechanism, and if you don't know mechanism, you can't really do much about it. And I should say that this smaller family here back at that time was contributed by Paul Grossfeld, who's here at UC San Diego as a pediatric cardiologist and collaborated with us on this work years ago. So we had a breakthrough, though, because Shinya Yamanaka, I had just recruited after I moved to Gladstone to come to establish a laboratory at Gladstone in 2007. He had described how to make human iPS cells. And so we immediately flew the family members from Dallas up to San Francisco and did skin biopsies, made iPS cell lines from four patients with the mutation, four without. We turned those into endothelial cells because we knew that those were the culprit cells. And I'd say for years, we learned nothing. And the reason, any of you who try to model disease know that unless you have isogenic controls and you've controlled the rest of the genome, there's too much noise in the system to figure these things out. And so it wasn't until we were able to do gene editing efficiently and make isogenic lines and then did full omic studies of where notch binds to DNA in the mutant setting, how it affects the epigenetics and the transcriptomics, that finally the biology laid itself out beautifully. And this work was led by Christina Theodoros, who was a very talented MD PhD student in our laboratory at the time and went on to train in pediatric genetics at Boston Children's, and we've now recruited to start her own laboratory at Gladstone. And what Christina found back then is that Notch's normal job in the heart turns out to be to block the valve cells from turning into osteoblast-like cells. That's its job, is to put a brake on this system. And you may ask, why would nature set it up that there would have to be a gene to block this cell fate transition, which is essentially a cellular reprogramming event? And it turns out that cardiac valves are not that different in their tissue compared to cartilage. And nature has used many of the same gene networks that it uses to make cartilage to make cardiac valves during embryogenesis. But it doesn't want it to go all the way to become bone-like, and so Notch is there to put the brakes on that. So it seems like the crux of this disease, this very common disease, is quite simple. It's a cellular reprogramming defect where the cells are changing their fate and losing their identity and becoming osteoblast-like. So not only did Christina figure that out, but since she started off by mapping broadly the gene networks that were shifting, what she found is that these gene networks were largely being driven by upregulation of just three key transcription factors, SOC7, TCF4, which mediates Wnt signaling, and SMAD1, which mediates BMP signaling. And if there are about 1,000 genes that were dysregulated in the cell fate transition, and about 80% of those, or 800, were directly or indirectly related to these three factors, and that if she knocked those down, these three factors down, you could largely shift the network back. So that was great. Now we understood mechanism a bit, and it looked like it funneled down to a discrete pathway. And so Christina decided to undertake a very interesting drug screen, not looking for molecules that upregulated Notch, but rather molecules that would shift the whole network, the whole gene network, but closer to normal. And she set up a machine learning algorithm back then to call normal cells or mutant cells and ask if a molecule, thousands of molecules, if any one of them would shift the whole network back. And I won't go through the details of that as it's published, but suffice it to say, she did find a very interesting small molecule that seemed to correct the whole gene network quite effectively. And this molecule turned out to be an estrogen receptor-related alpha inhibitor. And we validated that as a target subsequently with siRNA experiments and testing a host of other small molecules that also hit this target. And we're convinced now that this is, in fact, the true target. So that was great. We've now finally, after these years of effort, had a small molecule that might actually be able to shift this aberrant gene network back closer to normal. But you'll recall that we didn't have a mouse model to test this in, and we weren't going to go from a human iPS model to a clinical trial, of course. And so Christina had the clever idea that putting together a few observations. And one is that, as I mentioned, this is an age-dependent disease. We know that telomeres get shorter as people age, and we also knew that mice have much longer telomeres than humans. And so she asked whether mice might be protected from the disease simply because of their longer telomeres. And that's a testable hypothesis. And she did that by tested that by crossing Notch 1 heterozygous mice that were normal, with mice lacking TERC, which is the RNA component of telomerase. And when you do this in each generation of breeding, the telomeres get shorter and shorter. And it turns out that just in the second generation, where their telomeres are just a little bit shorter, that resulted in a nearly complete recapitulation of the human phenotype. It's really quite striking. And I'm showing you that here in a cross-section through the aortic valve of these mice just after a month of age. So it's really quite rapid. And on the top panels, what you see are the three nice aortic valve leaflets in a normal mouse that's TERC null, but not wild type. And in contrast, you can see on the bottom that these valves are very thick and they're heavily calcified, as indicated by Alizar in red here. So this is what we see in humans. And by ultrasound in these mice, we can detect the level of stenosis, which is exactly the way we detect it in humans, where if the valve aperture gets narrow, blood has to go across it faster in order to get the same amount of blood out to support the circulation. And so you can measure the speed of blood across there, and that tells you how much stenosis there is. But what this mouse model also allowed us to do is to go back and ask if that observation in vitro was really happening in vivo, namely, are these cells undergoing a cell fate switch to become more osteoblast-like in vivo? And for that, Christina stained these with valves with a marker of osteoblasts called RUNX2, which is a sort of master transcriptional regulator that drives the fate even. And you can, I think, easily appreciate here that these cells are all positive for RUNX2, suggesting that, in fact, this is likely a disease of cellular reprogramming. So this mouse model then gave us a way to test this drug in vivo in the setting of aortic valve stenosis. And we recognize that most in the human population, these individuals would come to the attention of a physician. You can hear the level of stenosis with the stethoscope. And then normally what we do right now is that we detect that and see it by ultrasound, document it, and then we just watch people over years. And as it gets worse and worse, then we do a surgical intervention. And the reason for that is that right now there's no medical therapy whatsoever for this condition. And so what we did in mice is we took the mice, I should say this was incompletely penetrant, so not all the mice had a degree of stenosis that we could detect by ultrasound. So we did ultrasounds at a month of age and isolated those with documented aortic valve stenosis, and then randomized those in a preclinical trial to either drug or placebo. And then we treated them for a month and then came back and repeated the ultrasounds after 1 month and asked, did this drug slow down progression? Because in humans, I think all we would have to do is slow down progression, not even arrest it. And because it's a disease of aging, most people will ultimately succumb to other conditions rather than need an intervention for this. So what I'm showing you here are the results from the placebo group, the control group, and on the y-axis is the amount percent change over that 1 month period of the degree of aortic valve stenosis. And you can see it's a rather wide range, but most of them are progressing as we'd expect just in a month, with a mean of somewhere around 80% in further stenosis. Now in stark contrast, when we looked at the cohort of mice that had been treated, it looked something like this. While there are a couple of mice that did progress, the vast majority had little to no progression, but most strikingly, half of the mice actually had regression. So it looks like we, with this drug, we're actually also able to not just stop, but maybe even reverse in part some of the degree of stenosis. So this is really exciting. We think we might actually have a drug that could be effective for this common disease. But everything I've shown you so far is related to animals with Notch mutations. And it turns out that, well, I think I didn't mention this, probably only 4 to 5% of the population with this disease will present with mutations in Notch or pathway members. And so those are going to be more rare conditions. Most people will not have an identifiable genetic condition, even though it's likely a combination of factors leading to this disease. But we do believe that for most people, even if they don't have Notch mutations, the cause of the disease is going to be similar, which is a shift of cell identity into an osteoblast-like fate and then laying down of calcium. And so we decided to test this idea by collecting primary aortic valve endothelial cells from patients who had had their valve explanted at time of surgery, and normally the surgeons would throw it in the trash. We could get those and grow these actual aortic human cells. And so we did that for a bunch of normal valves, a number of calcified 3-leaflet valves, and calcified 2-leaflet valves. And the first thing we observed by sequencing their RNA is that these, the same gene network was shifted, and in particular, these same three transcriptional drivers were all upregulated. So that suggested that, yes, the same network is being altered even in the absence of Notch mutations. And most importantly, this same ERR alpha inhibitor restored the gene network broadly, and in particular, these three transcription factors. So with this information, what we do believe we have now is a viable drug that can be taken forward in clinical trials. And I should say we've advanced the chemistry of this molecule, so it's got high potency and low toxicity features and good PK values. And so our vision now is that we finally may have an oral once-a-day drug that could be used to at least slow down or arrest the progression of this very common disease. So that story, I should say, as a physician scientist particularly, probably represents one of the most satisfying arcs of discovery of my career, going from taking care of a patient to identifying the genetic cause, understanding mechanism, and actually having a potential therapeutic that could alter the way we treat this disease. So the last story I want to share with you is, again, related to genetics, but it is an unpublished story related to understanding why congenital lesions occur. And I should first say that as a result of a broad nationwide consortium funded by the NHLBI, where we've sequenced over 5,000 children and their parents with congenital heart disease, we can now understand with the genetic basis about half of congenital heart defects, which is a big advancement for us. That still leaves about half that are in this pie chart that are unknown causes, and we're still working on. But even amongst the half that we quote unquote understand, I want to draw your attention to this light blue pie. That is the pie where we understand the cause because of aneuploidies. Now, that gives us some satisfaction that we understand the genetic basis, but aneuploidies often involve large portions of the chromosome, and actually we generally don't understand the specific genes that might be driving this. And again, if you don't understand mechanism, there's not a lot we can do. And of course, the most common of all of these aneuploidies is trisomy 21, which results in Down syndrome. And it turns out that children with Down syndrome, about half of them are born with cardiac defects, mostly of the septal defects where the walls between the atria and ventricles have holes in them and there's communication of blood between the chambers. Now, there's one very specific type of septal defect that I've illustrated here in this cartoon, which is at the level of where the separation is between the atrial chambers at the top and the ventricular chambers here, and involves the valves that separate these. And here, there's free communication between all four chambers in what we call an atrioventricular septal defect because of a defect at this specific level of the heart. And this happens in children without Down syndrome also, but in Down syndrome, this occurs with a thousandfold increase incidence, thousandfold. So there's clearly something very specific going on here in trisomy 21 that is resulting in this specific area of the heart being affected. And we haven't known the genetic cause of this in the past. And this is the problem that Sanjeev Ranade, a postdoc fellow in the laboratory, undertook several years ago, and Sanjeev is now here at the Sanford Burnham Institute with running his own laboratory. And I want to share with you the beautiful work that he's done while he was in the lab and is continuing here in his own laboratory. So the question obviously is, what are the gene or genes on chromosome 21 that are driving this type of defect? And before I share with you the story, there's one piece of developmental biology background you need to know, which is that if you look at a developing mouse embryo, like you see here from the side, here's the left ventricle, the left atrium, and this is the region that's between the atrium ventricular chambers that we call the atrioventricular canal. And if you do a cross-section through this, you can easily see that the muscle in as a cuff around this specific area is different from the neighboring muscle in the ventricle and atria. And you can see that by gene expression of this transcription factor, TBX2, where it's only expressed in this cuff of muscle and not here, in contrast to other genes that are only expressed in the chamber myocardium, but not this atrioventricular myocardium. So this is a very specialized muscle right around where the valves will form and the septa will form, separating the chambers, and is exactly where the defect occurs in this disease. And so the approach Sanjeev took was to use iPS cells that were made from people walking around who are mosaic for trisomy 21. These people don't have any disease. They have a higher risk of having an offspring with trisomy 21, but they're fine. But when you make iPS cells from these mosaics, in the same dish, you'll get disomic iPS lines and trisomic. So again, the key is this gives you isogenic controls. And so he did that and differentiated them to cardiomyocytes and did single-cell RNA sequencing. And here we can annotate cells shown here that are actually of the type of specifically of the atrioventricular myocardium and others that are ventricular myocardium. So we can distinguish by single-cell RNA-seq this specialized population. And here's what I thought was a really key observation that made the rest of the project possible. And that is, when you look at just the transcriptome in these specific cells, there was a very clear difference between disomic and trisomic cells. And that's illustrated here in the dot plot of a number of genes where you could clearly see the pattern is different between disomic and trisomic. And importantly, what we observed is that the genes that were normally high in the atrioventricular canal myocardium, the specialized myocardium, were all downregulated. And in contrast, the genes that were normally low, the ventricular myocardial genes, were now upregulated. So what it seemed like was going on here is maybe this disease is one of, again, reprogramming in part of these specialized myocardium to now be more like ventricular myocardium, and that could be the crux of the disease. And so now this gives us an assay to go after where some gene or genes on chromosome 21 must be causing this pattern shift. So now the problem becomes quite simple, although it was a lot of work to find it, but conceptually it's simple. And it was we were aided in the fact that chromosome 21 is one of the smaller chromosomes. There are only 24 genes on it, 241 genes rather. And then there had been a mouse model already made of trisomy 21 with the syntenic region. And that model recapitulates the cardiac defects and only had duplication of less than 150 genes. So it must be one or more of those genes because we are seeing the cardiac defect. And I should say from the mouse data genetics, it was clear that there are likely at least two loci that both need to be duplicated to be sufficient for the defect, but each being necessary. And then our laboratory had over the years made a mouse atlas of all the genes expressed during the heart during development. And of these 148 genes, only 66 were ever expressed in any cell type in the heart. And so we figured it had to be those, since the mouse also has the defect. So that got it down to a more narrow number. And this then, what Sanjeev decided to do, is take advantage of the CRISPR activation approach. And now any of you who have done CRISPR-A know that the problem with CRISPR-A is that you don't ever get really high levels of activation. You get maybe 50%, maybe 100%, but not, you don't get tenfold. But for us, that was perfect, because in trisomy, we're only getting 50% activation. And so Sanjeev inserted the Cas9 VPR cassette into the disomic line, so he could use guide RNAs to each of the 66 genes and ask, do any of the guide RNAs then recapitulate that pattern shift that I showed you. So he introduced, using a crop-seq approach, a lentivirus library of the guide RNAs, differentiated them to cardiomyocytes, and then did single-cell RNA-seq. And just in that atrioventricular canal myocardial population, asked, do any of the guide RNAs make that pattern shift occur to be more trisomy-like? And working with Katie Pollard's lab, Sean Whalen and Katie Pollard's lab, they set up a machine learning algorithm that would call hits. And so here, what I'm showing you in red in this UMAP plot are the disomic cells. Blue are the trisomic, so they clearly separate in space. The gray dots are each of the guide RNAs. And you can see most guide RNAs don't do anything, which is what we'd expect. But some cause a shift closer to the trisomic state. And we then took those and did secondary tests with them individually, not in a pool screen. And to make a long story short, one of the guide RNAs virtually recapitulated the pattern shift. And that turned out to be a guide RNA activating a gene called HMGN1, which many of you will know is a nucleosome binding protein that functions as often as a co-activator, sometimes as a co-repressor at target sites, particularly of cell type specific transcription factors. And so what I'm showing you here again is that dot plot with the disomic control here, the trisomic all the way on your right, and then in the middle is activation just of HMGN1 with the guide RNA, and you can see it largely recapitulates the pattern. And particularly, these genes like TBX2 that I showed you and RSpondin3 that are normally high in the atrioventricular canal myocardium are similarly downregulated by HMGN1, like in the trisomic condition. And the chamber myocardial genes, which are upregulated in trisomy, are also upregulated just with HMGN1. And so this suggests that this one gene on chromosome 21 at least is shifting the transcriptome similar to what we see in trisomy with this identity shift, if you will, for the specialized myocardium to be less specialized. So that was encouraging. But of course, what we want to know really is in vivo, is this critical? And we do have a way to test that, of course, because I told you we have a mouse model. And we have mice that are heterozygous for HMGN1. So the simple experiment is to cross the trisomic mouse with mice that are heterozygous for HMGN1. And now you've reduced the dose of HMGN1 to 2 alleles, where everything else has stayed the same. And if this is the key gene, or one of the key genes, then we should rescue the phenotype. And so we did that, and this is the result we found, particularly for the more serious cardiac defects, septal and outflow tract defects. You can see here the trisomic mice, we get a very significant increase compared to wild type. And just by removing one allele of HMGN1, we rescue this phenotype of the cardiac defects in vivo. So we believe this is convincing evidence that HMGN1 is likely at least one of the major genes. There's been very good literature suggesting that a kinase DIRC1A is another critical gene, and we're now trying to test if both of these together could be sufficient. But as I mentioned, obviously the key question now is, where does HMGN bind in these cells, and how does it affect gene transcription? And we're eagerly pursuing those kind of experiments in collaboration with Vijay Ramani's laboratory. He has expertise in this area. But what we think is going on, even as we learn mechanism, is that the crux of this disease is likely a reprogramming event again, where this specialized myocardium gets reprogrammed to be more like the ventricular myocardium that it shouldn't be, and then that affects its signals that it's sending to the endocardium to then affect the development of the valves and the septa in this region. So what I've tried to show you today is how we can go from understanding the developmental biology and molecular biology of the system to being able to leverage that both for regenerative medicine purposes and mechanistic understanding of the genetics of human disease in ways that will allow us to intervene. And I tried to mention the brilliant trainees that have come through the lab and worked on these projects over the years. This is, many of them are listed here, including Sanjeev, and great collaborators. And this is my current laboratory, fairly recent picture. And with that, I'll close and be happy to take any questions. Thank you very much.
Incredible work. It's really mind-blowing. Anyway, I had two questions. One was about the last story. You showed RBFOX1 changes, and that is a regulator of embryonic splicing. Have you looked into alterations in splicing as an epitranscriptomic instability that could actually lead to what's going on in the specification of what should be atrioventricular, you know, tissue as opposed to myocardial ventricular wall?
Yeah, it's a great question, and we have worked on splicing in other projects, and we're eager to understand that it's hard to do with the 10x platform with single cell because you don't get full, you know, things to transcriptomes to be able to do understand splicing. There are some computational approaches that try to do that. And we've been trying to collaborate with Lars Steinmetz at Stanford, who's developed some of those, but we haven't succeeded there.
You can do the 5' version, just saying.
We can,
So then the other question is about anakinra. So you're showing IL-1 upregulation and IL-1 beta specifically. You can give anakinra, which is the IL-1 receptor that's exogenous that could mop up that IL-1 beta. Have you thought about that in terms of preventing that myocardial reprogramming towards a fibrotic state?
We have, and in fact, we have used that, and it was effective. The problem that there had been a clinical trial of the IL-1 antibody that had been done. It didn't get approval because of a number of side effects of blocking the immune system more broadly. It led to a greater risk of infection. So that's why I think getting with a greater degree of specificity that wouldn't affect more broadly is key. But conceptually, that I think showed us that this is the right pathway to go after.
Absolutely fantastic. So I have 3 questions about the Notch1 work, but I promise they're short. They're all mostly yes-no questions. For the Notch1 sort of reprogramming to a more osteoblastic-like state, that makes total sense. I'm curious whether there's any explanation for perhaps the valve formation of a bicuspid format as opposed to tricuspid. Not sure what you thought about that. In the valve explants that you got from people who got the removal or the swap surgery, was there any genomic evidence for, say, somatic variants in the Notch1 pathway? And then finally, I was wondering when you tested the ER-alpha blocking drug, whether or not there were any adverse effects on the female mice.
So I'll try to be brief in my answers as well.
Sorry.
For the first step, we haven't been able to gain a lot of insight on the developmental part of the anomaly, which is disappointing to me because that's actually what I'm probably most interested in. But our mice don't get bicuspid aortic valve with this condition, so that's been a rate-limiting step. So we don't fully understand that part. For the second question related to the
somatic variants. Somatic variants.
We haven't looked at that, so I don't know if that's the case, but it's a possibility that there could be specific variation there. And the third, we don't see sex differences in those mice. I should say, which I forgot to mention, that the vascular calcification that occurs commonly in humans is very pathologically looks very similar to what we see in the valve. And when we do the clinical trial, we'll be looking at vascular calcification also. We just don't know if it would work for that also because there's not a good mouse model at all for vascular calcification, but we have every reason to think that it'll affect there also. Yes.
Amazing talk. Really inspiring. I love the idea of transforming faith in vivo, and that's happening in the heart. We see it a lot in epithelial tissue, so seeing it in the heart, it's absolutely amazing. My question relates more on lots of those changes that you've seen in the, that you've shown in those heat maps are actually niche factors, TGF-beta, Wnt, VGFs. Have you, or maybe what are your thoughts around this fate switch and how the cells that are actually undergoing this fate switch changing their environment?
Yeah, so those, you're absolutely right. And those that, what I didn't say is those myocardial cells, we know a lot of the genes that are involved in valve formation, and they're dependent on secreted factors like those that get sent and received by the neighboring endocardium. And then the endocardium forms the valves and these septal regions. So we do think that those are critical downstream targets that are directly affected by the abnormality of that specialized myocardium. There are specialized TGF-betas that are only secreted from that valve myocardium. And there are special TGF-beta receptors that are only expressed in the endocardium next to the valve, not in the endocardium in the chambers. And there's decades of research on that, so we know the pathways quite well. Exactly, you're spot on. Yes.
So trisomy 21 has this high incidence of these endocardial cushion defect kind of things, but I'm wondering, since you seem like you maybe have one of the main factors there, half the patients with trisomy 21 don't have congenital heart defects, but this would suggest they have some sort of predisposition. I'm wondering if any work has been done in those that don't, just look at maybe gene-environment interactions or modifier genes that might predispose to the, that more severe, you know, phenotype.
Yeah, it's a great point. And why is it that the half don't have disease? And if you could figure that out, maybe there's a prevention modality. There's actually been a lot of effort, not by our lab, but by others in the field to sequence large cohorts of people with trisomy 21 that have heart disease and those that don't, to look for modifier genes. And it's been frustrating for the field. So far, it hasn't been obvious what there must be, but we haven't had the power, I think, to identify that as yet. Yeah, it's a great point.
Well, I don't, while we wait for more questions in the room, we'll take one off of the Zoom. Given that you found an association between telomere shortening and aortic stenosis, does that give you any insight into aging-related diseases of the heart?
Yeah, or a period, aging-related. So when we had that finding, I immediately, of course, went to Liz Blackburn's office, which is on campus, before she'd come to San Diego briefly, went to share the data with her and ask her for insights. And I was surprised to learn that the field didn't have a good handle on why telomere shortening was associated with aging, even though it's known to be. And what I am actually very excited about that we're pursuing right now is the idea that we actually might have one of the best models that exist to figure out mechanism for telomere shortening relationship to aging. And so one theory in the field is that the telomeres loop back to contact promoters throughout the genome and regulate transcription. And the way to test that experimentally would be able to do Hi-C or three-dimensional conformation experiments in the setting of these various mutations. The problem is it's a very small subset of cells in the valve that are affected. And so you can't really figure that out unless you can do single cell Hi-C. And only recently has the technology developed to do that. And Longxi Tan at Stanford is one who has developed some of that technology. And so we're working with his lab now, right now, and have that single cell Hi-C working. And it looks like that's exactly what we're seeing. And I think we might be able to crack that, but we don't have the answer right now.
Dyskeratosis congenita, they have mutations in TERC. Could you make an iPS line out of that and do your Hi-C experiment?
Yes, that could be useful. What we have done just in the last few weeks is a Hi-C experiment with the mice that are null for TERC, and then mice that are null for TERC and heterozygous for NOTCH. And I'll just share with you our preliminary results, which I'm still trying to understand. It turns out that in the NOTCH heterozygous setting, there's a decrease in contacts and transcription of many of the genes that are osteoblast-like. And then in the TERC knockout, that's true of TERC knockout by itself. And then together, it's exaggerated. So they seem to be hitting the same genes even by themselves, and it's synergistic. And so now we're still trying to figure out why.
Is there a window of opportunity after an infarct where you cannot do reprogramming in the heart? In other words, the conversion from non-cardiomyocytes into a cardiomyocyte where nothing you do will change it?
Yes, I think if you do it for a variety of reasons, it wouldn't be done in the acute setting immediately. And part of that is if we were able to do it very efficiently, you want your fibroblasts there to make scar and not have a cardiac rupture. I actually don't think we're at danger for that because we're not so good at it. The efficiency is not where we want it to be. The bigger reason that won't be done is that for a clinical trial purpose, there's so much variability patient to patient in the acute setting of where they'll end up that clinical trials become nearly impossible to see a signal because there's so much variability from the time an injury occurs to where that patient will land at their baseline after revascularization and other medical therapies. And so you're just going to get a ton of noise. I don't think you'd ever see a signal. So I think in clinical trials, it'll have to be once a patient has stabilized, kind of like we did in the pig, they've stabilized in whatever their decrement will be in their cardiac function. So you have a reliable change you can track.
So you define when it's too early. Is there a point where it's too late?
We don't know that answer. It's hard to do really chronic studies in animals to wait a long time and do it, particularly in pigs. So honestly, we don't know the answer.
Oh, okay. We'll have you be the last question.
I have one last question about the stability of the reprogramming. So you show in one of your first studies that you can reprogram fibroblasts to cardiomyocytes in a scar tissue. How stable is this change? And whether they stay forever cardiomyocytes or they can change fate?
As Prince would say, forever is a mighty long time. what we do know, having studied the epigenetics of the switch, is that it's a wholesale epigenetic shift that appears to be very stable. And in vivo, in mice, when we've gone several months out, it appears to be stable. So we have every reason to believe that after that, you've overcome that epigenetic barrier and landed in a different valley, let's say, using the Waddington landscape as an example, that it would be an equally difficult hurdle to get back. So I think that's kind of how we think about it, but time will tell.
Okay. I think we want to thank Deepak for just a really inspiring example of what we've often talked about here, bedside to bench and then back to the bedside, and for just truly illuminating. Thanks so much.
Thank you.